Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami.
So it's very lovely to be here back at Abhayagiri after 5 years or so since my last visit. And especially lovely to see so many people gathered for the appositor evening and to hear you all taking the precepts. I think each group has a slightly different way of doing it, and I was just really enjoying hearing you reciting the refuges, particularly. For some reason, it was quite touching. I've been here for 3 or 4 days now, and I'll be staying for another day or so until Monday morning. I came over to America specifically to attend a teacher's conference at Spirit Rock, and had a week or so before. And it felt like a very nice opportunity to come and visit the monastery here. I always enjoy spending time in monasteries. Something very pleasant about the monastic routine and living with people who have a similar aspiration, similar interest. Both the monastics and also the lay people who've been staying here, we've had some nice discussions at tea time, interesting questions. And it's always just very lovely to consider these themes, what it is to be a human being living on the planet at this time, and how can we make the best possible use of this opportunity that we all have. It's really important stuff, actually, isn't it? So this evening I have the opportunity to offer some reflections on these kind of themes. One of the things that comes to mind is just what an incredible opportunity it is to have a chance to hear the Dhamma, to have come across this teaching, this way of practice. I began to be aware of suffering, well, I suppose fairly early on in my life, and it was kind of in my early 20s that I began to be interested in meditation. That seemed to be something that was offering a possibility of living with a little bit more sanity, a little bit more sense of ease and well-being, and seemed to provide some bridge between the ideal of, you know, what I was aspiring to as a human being. I wanted to be good and kind and loving and generous all the time, and not to be worried and fearful and anxious, and certainly not to be jealous. That was a big thing for me, jealousy. And I thought that meditation would help. And I hadn't actually particularly come across Buddhist meditation at that time. I practiced within different traditions before I finally met Ajahn Sumedho shortly after his arrival in London in 1977. And hearing him teach, it sort of sounded, I didn't actually even realize it was Buddhist teachings he was sharing, because it just seemed like common sense. I just thought, this is good stuff, I thought. Makes a lot of sense. And it was actually only on my second retreat that I began to see some kind of a pattern. Four Noble Truths, Eightfold Path. Began to realize that there were quite specific teachings that were being offered. And I was very interested, very excited, because I really had the sense that if I could apply these teachings to my own life, that perhaps... Well, actually, it wasn't even just a perhaps. It was the sense of that this was something that could bring about the ending of suffering. Obviously not physical pain. It was clear that the body was going to die at some stage, although it wasn't something I thought about very much, but it was definitely on the cards, as they say. But the suffering that I was interested in ending was the mind-created suffering. And, of course, it's expressed so very clearly in the Four Noble Truths. that there is suffering and that there's a reason why we suffer, and we suffer because of wanting things to be different from how they are. And so I didn't want to be jealous, I didn't want to be fearful and anxious, I didn't want to be irritable and grumpy, I didn't want to be confused and doubtful and fearful and anxious. These were things I didn't want. And I wanted to be good and kind and loving and generous and happy and at ease. So, seeing that if we let go of the desire for things to be otherwise, then that essentially is takes us to a place of ease, inner ease, a sense of peacefulness. It wasn't necessarily going to get rid of the unpleasant conditions, it wasn't going to make the pleasant conditions last forever, but at least there was a sense of peaceful acceptance of things as they were, things as they are. I'm always interested that the Buddha's teachings is actually very realistic and very practical. I'm also interested in the fact that they invite us to begin where we are. We were having a conversation a few days ago about the difference between the way that the male approach to practice and the female approach to practice. And I shared an observation that arose from me fairly early on, and it's a shocking generalization, really. I mean, shocking that one would make such a generalization, but it seemed to be hold true, and to a large degree that the male mind tends to be interested in enlightenment. It sort of has a very clear sense of the goal and aiming towards that goal. Whereas for myself and the majority of other women that I had spoken with, we just wanted to stop suffering quite so much. And in some ways, both approaches are important. The longer-term view, the sense of aspiration, and also just beginning from where we are. You know, the willingness to start off with this breath, this body, this mind as it is right now. This is something that I tend to emphasize because I think it's really important. Because I think in practice sometimes we can become very intimidated by the teaching. It can seem so lofty and so sort of almost unattainable. You think, well, I could never do that. And we look around at the people around us and we think, oh, they can do it, but I can't do it. I could never do it. And we listen to the teachings and we think, oh, I can't do it like that. Or we maybe hear about a technique or a strategy and we think, oh, well, that's not how I see it. I can't do it. And we can very easily get discouraged. And it can take a long time before we actually see that actually it's about where I am right now, what's happening for me right now. Not about anybody else, not about Venerable So-and-so or Ajahn So-and-so or Lumpur So-and-so or the Buddha or the enlightened disciples. It's about this life, this human being, as it is right now, with all its doubts, worries, fears, anxieties, or its conceit, whatever it might be, whatever our tendency, it's what's happening right now for this being, the history, the life, the family situation, the gifts, the abilities, the interests, the fears. I'm interested in the fact that the teaching is a universal teaching. that the Buddha, in his brilliance, was able to present teachings that were actually relevant for each one of us. You know, each one of us can pick up the teachings and apply them to our own situation. And yet for each one of us, the situation that we're applying it to is completely different. I mean, never mind the countless previous lifetimes that we've had, just this very lifetime, for each one of us, we come from very different backgrounds, very different experiences. I mean, even people who are born like as identical twins in the same family with the same parents, for them, their experience is totally different, the way that people relate to them, the people they meet. Never mind for all of us who come from different families, different cultures, well, many people from different cultures, different backgrounds. We've been on the planet different lengths of time. So very, very different experiences. And these teachings are relevant for each one of us, the experience that we have. Because it's about what's happening here now. Getting our feet on the ground. What's happening for us right now? We were sitting here in meditation together, and I must say I was very impressed at how the sense of stillness and quiet in the hall here. You know, people seemed really settled, really steady. I'm imagining that for some of you, perhaps the mind was very still and strong sense of focus. And I'm imagining also that for some of you, there was maybe thinking, remembering, thinking, planning, thinking about what's happened today, thinking about what might happen tomorrow, ideas, concerns. And there might have also been a struggle to stop that thinking. I shouldn't be thinking. This is normal. And yet in the practice, we begin from where we are. If there's thinking, then we simply recognize, okay, there's thinking right now. How can I be peaceful with a mind that is full of thoughts? How can I let go of that struggle for things to be otherwise? I'm very interested in the extent to which we tend to complicate our practice. Many people I speak with and I ask about their meditation, they say, oh yes, yes, I practice meditation, but I'm not very good at it. Or, I don't do it enough. Or, well, I would like to meditate, but my mind is much too busy. I can't meditate. The Buddha's teachings, the Buddha's way of practice is relevant for all of us. For some people, perhaps they do have a natural ability to focus the mind. Perhaps they've had the opportunity to really develop their meditation. You know, some of the community have spent time in Thailand and been able to spend long periods of time developing their meditation practice with very fine teachers. And for others, there hasn't been that opportunity. But that doesn't matter, because we're beginning from where we are, taking these teachings, applying them in our own lives. One of the teachings that I like very much is the teachings on the paramitas, because these perfections, these qualities, are qualities that each one of us can develop in our lives, and generosity, ethical conduct, renunciation, discernment, energy, patience, truthfulness, resolution, kindness, equanimity. These qualities that are relevant to our meditation, and they're also relevant to just our daily life practice, how we live. It was interesting this evening, we were talking about travelling in India and seeing beggars and our response to people who have very little. And there was some discussion about what happens if you give some money or give some food to some beggars. You know, if you offer food to one beggar, then all the others come running. And how difficult that is, how difficult that is to deal with. And an experience I had in India, which was quite mind-blowing actually, was when I was there as a nun on pilgrimage about 15, 16 years ago. And one of the things that I had really wanted to do was to go on alms round in India, because I'd heard from Ajahn Sujita, had been a few years before, and he'd talked a lot about going for alms. And I was there on pilgrimage on my own with a layperson, and I was far too timid, far too shy to go out with my alms bowl on my own. And then I met a group of monks and nuns who were kind of travelling together, and they invited me to join them for when they went for alms in Bodh Gaya. And we went cover quite a wide area, and we went to some of the quite poor villages where people got very excited when they saw us coming, and they brought food to put into our bowls. These were very poor people who were offering us food. And then we walked into the main street, the main part of Bodh Gaya, where all the beggars are. And I have to mention that I was right at the very back of the line. I was the most junior person, just about. And I would never have done this on my own, but the leader of the group stood in front of the beggars. And I thought, what's happening here? You know, we're not going to be begging from these people who have nothing, you know, standing with our bowls. You know, what's he expecting? But, you know, I was with the group. I didn't have any choice in the matter. I mean, I could have just walked away, but I'm very well behaved. I wouldn't do something like that. I'm a good nun. So I stood with the other monks and nuns with my bowl. And gradually, what I saw happening was these beggars, they had these... In their clothing, they had these little kind of knots with just a few coins tied up in their robes, in their clothing. Mm. And they took out a coin. Mm. And they went and they bought biscuits. Mm. And they put one biscuit into our bowls, into each bowl. And then another of these people had a plastic bag with some bread. And he put a bit of bread into each bowl. And it was interesting just to see, to observe what the sense of gladness and joy at being able to give. Their role was one to receive, to beg, to receive. They weren't used to giving, and yet one could see the sense of dignity, the sense of joy that arose. So that was a very powerful experience for me, to be through making myself available to receive from people who had very, very little, and to give them a chance to experience giving, to experience dana. It's an interesting position to be in, being an alms mendicant. And recently I'm in the process of starting a small hermitage up in Scotland, And one of the things that I really want to do is to go for alms in the local town. But again, I feel incredibly shy, incredibly bashful, embarrassed. And so far I haven't done it. My excuse has been that I wanted to check in with a local policeman so that he would know what I was doing in case people complained. And eventually I've tracked down the local policeman and we've had an email exchange and he confirms that it's completely all right. Since I'm not asking for money, I'm not going from door to door, he doesn't see any problem with this. So when I go back there for the Vasa, I'm not going to have any excuse anymore. The reason it's difficult, of course, is because of my Western conditioning. And also it's in my home country. I come from Scotland. And now I actually know many of the people in the village. So this is a hurdle. And if I can just keep reminding myself of how much joy arises from giving, from dana, that will help me to do that. It's what has helped me in the past, going for alms around Chithurst Monastery, which is where we first started doing what we call the faith bindapat. Because the Western conditioning is, you know, this is crazy. You know, you're making yourself dependent on other people. You know, how can you do it? What happens if nobody offers you any food? And then walking mindfully, that's one of the blessings of the walking meditation practice, because when we walk rather than the mind going off, we can just be steady one step at a time, not thinking about the past or thinking about the future, just this step, this moment, this breath. And then going and standing. And seeing that one's presence is a presence that is not asking, but more bestowing. You know, may all beings be well. That's what goes in my heart when I'm waiting. Just may all beings be well. And see it as an opportunity to provide an occasion where someone can practice generosity, do something that they might not normally do, come and put food into somebody's bowl. So I contemplate this dana and the blessings of dana, and I shall continue to contemplate this when I walk into Comrie and stand with my bowl at the start of the bus. I love contemplating this quality of generosity of heart, because it's something that applies both to material generosity, looking at ways that we can make offerings to the monastery, make offerings to one another, share what we have with each other, and experience that joyfulness that comes from that. But I also like to consider generosity of heart in terms of how we relate with each other. You know, can we bring forth a generosity of heart in our relationships? I remember one time being quite hurt by something that had happened in our community, and there was one particular person involved, and I really wanted that person to suffer. I really wanted them to, in some way, receive or experience the pain that I had experienced as a result of what had happened. And I was surprised at how strong this feeling was of wanting to hurt, wanting to humiliate. And it came to me that this wasn't what the Buddha would have recommended. And I decided to stop doing that and instead to practice a generosity of heart, a kindness. I couldn't actually send forth a lot of kindness, but at least I could stop dwelling in that state of negativity. And I did that for a while, and it was remarkable, the sense of blessing that came into the heart, just letting go of that desire to hurt or harm. And gradually, that was replaced by, may that being be well, may that being not suffer. This is a more subtle aspect of generosity. Are we able to let go of our grudges, to let go of our ill will, to let go of the wanting to punish or blame or criticize or judge, pay back the harm that has been done? Bringing forth this generosity, this kindness of heart, that is willing to give the benefit of the doubt. You know, maybe that person wasn't intending to harm. Maybe that person was hurting us just because they'd been hurt. Maybe because they were confused. Maybe because they were frightened. I'm quite interested in fear, because I notice that my meanest things arise when I'm frightened, when I'm struggling for survival, when I want to establish a position for myself, when I'm frightened that my position is going to get taken away. So when people hurt us, perhaps they're frightened. Perhaps they're jealous. All of these are very unpleasant conditions. So perhaps if we can give the benefit of the doubt, perhaps if we can bring forth that generosity of heart, we can, instead of wanting to hurt, we can wish them well, that they may feel peaceful and at ease inwardly. I'm not going to talk about all 10 paramitas, just in case you're worried. I was just interested in this theme of generosity, because it is something that we can all of us practice. And it is something that is so beneficial, brings such a lovely sense into the heart, a sense of joyfulness. So even if we don't have very much, just being able to share, to give what we have. I remember years ago when I was an Anagarika, a novice in our monastery, and we used to do a lot of cooking. And I used to really enjoy cooking. And we had a lot of fun cooking. But there was one time that somebody had offered some money for a meal. And I think I was given, you know, the choice of what to cook. And so I planned this meal and went out and got all the best possible ingredients. And prepared this meal, but I hadn't allowed enough time for the food to cook properly, and it was, you know, very expensive food, and it was almost completely uneatable. And it was a very interesting experience to have prepared something. I mean, I'd done my very, very best to prepare something really, really fine and wonderful, and it just wasn't very good. I don't know if you've had experiences of that, where you really want to offer something that's really good, the best, and you know that it's not very good, it's not the best. And you know that everybody knows that you've tried your best, to make this really fine thing, this really wonderful thing, and it's just not very good. That requires a special kind of generosity of heart and a humility. Reminds me years ago of when I was on my very, very first retreat. It was actually in a Christian monastery. I wasn't Buddhist at the time. And it was a monastery where they were still chanting in Latin, this wonderful Gregorian chanting in a Benedictine monastery up in Scotland. And it was just exquisite, the chanting. And I used to listen to this. But there was one monk, one old monk, whose voice had completely gone. And it sounded terrible. And he would do this chanting, and I would listen to it. And rather than being concerned about the quality of the sound, what I focused on was just the quality of the heart that was willing to offer this. You know, it was what he had. It was the best he could offer from his heart. And that was very, very special for me. It was very helpful because, in a way, our lives are kind of like an offering, aren't they? You know, we dedicate our lives, like now as a Buddhist nun, I give my life for the Dhamma. And sometimes what I'm able to give, you know, I can think, well, that wasn't bad, Chandasiri. That was pretty good. And other times, you know, I mess up. I don't always get it right. And I think it's helpful for us all just to consider, like, our intention, our wholesome intention. You know, we do the best we can, and just to keep remembering that as a way of counterbalancing the tendency to always be judging and criticizing. You know, I think it's pretty much the same in America as it is in Britain. You know, we're quite competitive, and that's how we've been conditioned. You know, we want to be the best, the top of the class, to get A grades. That's what you say in America, to get A, straight A's. To be the best, to get praised. That's what we want. And we bring that kind of mindset into our practice, wanting to be the best, not wanting to fail. But our best is perhaps not quite you know, even if we try our best, maybe we don't get the best result. Maybe we make a mistake, maybe we make a fool of ourselves, maybe we burn the food, maybe we say something foolish, maybe we fall asleep in our meditation, maybe we're really restless and agitated in our meditation. But we can bring forth our effort to be present. This is how it is right now. That's what the Buddha asks of us, to be present, here, now. To attend carefully to this moment as best we can. We make mistakes. All of us make mistakes. And the trick is to learn from our mistakes. And if we make a mistake, can we consider carefully what happened? You know, why did we say that thing? Why did we do that thing? What was going on for us? Maybe we didn't know. Maybe we didn't understand what was required. We did what we thought was the right thing. It turned out not to be the right thing. Maybe that's what happened. Sometimes we think we should know everything, like coming to the monastery. Some of you, I know, find it difficult to, you know, you're concerned about getting it wrong, making a mistake, offending somebody, causing somebody to break a rule. I used to be terrified about you know, that I might cause a monk to break a rule and get him into trouble because I'd not known what to do, not done it properly. But how can we know? You know, if we're new here, how can we possibly know? And we can learn gradually by asking. We can learn by observing, noticing how other people do things. That's a good way to learn, isn't it? Notice what seems to bring a good result, what enables things to flow in a beautiful way. Bring a sense of curiosity, a sense of interest. See if you can replace the anxiety with a sense of curiosity. I'm in a new place. This is a different form. I haven't done this before. What are other people doing? How are they doing it? Oh, well, maybe I'll do it like that. Rather than, oh dear, I'm going to get it wrong. I don't know what to do. One of the things I've noticed is that when I'm relaxed, I seem to be less likely to make mistakes. I seem to learn better. You know, when I'm at ease. So when I welcome people to the monastery in England or at the Hermitage in Scotland, you know, one of the things that I try to do is to help people to feel comfortable, to feel at ease, so that they're able to learn, able to observe. I notice when I'm tense and anxious, I tend to be a bit stupid, actually. Not to blame anybody for feeling tense and anxious, but to see how important it is to just try to establish a sense of inner ease, a sense of inner well-being. So how do we do that if we're feeling tense and anxious? And what's the trick? The Buddha gave us some very simple tools, the foundations of mindfulness. Some of you know this teaching, don't you? Establishing presence. So how do we establish presence with a feeling of tension and anxiety, a fearfulness about getting it wrong? Well, coming to the body is a good starting place, isn't it? Just what does the body feel like? Can we relax the body? And can we notice the shoulders hunched up, the belly in a knot, the hands clenched, the face tense? Can we take a nice deep breath in and then just breathe out and relax? Establish awareness with the breath. That's a very useful starting point. Establishing a sense of presence, our feet on the ground, a sense of contact with the earth. The Buddha at Chithurst Monastery is the Touching the Earth Buddha. And some of you have seen the picture of the Buddha touching the earth. I always find that a very helpful image. Just touching the earth, establishing presence here, now. Relaxing. Breathing. So Abhayagiri, the fearlessness, fearless mountain monastery. Establishing presence as a way of overcoming fear. There's a sutta that we recite, 28 Buddhist sutta, and it talks about Dhamma as the medicine for fear. Because fear is always about something that might happen, isn't it? You know, frightened of going to the dentist, frightened of a difficult conversation that we're going to have, frightened, you know, that we're going to die or get sick. I remember being very frightened that my parents were going to die. You know, I just couldn't imagine how people could survive being bereaved. I just didn't know how they did it. And this was about, 10 years before my parents actually did die. And I realized that I could either spend the next, the rest of their lives worrying about the fact that they were going to die, or instead I could just establish presence. I could enjoy being with them as long as they were alive. So I decided to do that, rather than be frightened of something that was going to happen in the future, or that might happen in the future. So establishing presence, establishing the refuge in Dhamma, here and now. The truth that we experience here and now, the Dhamma, here and now, as a way of overcoming fear about what might happen. Very, very useful. I mean, certainly reading in the papers, and sort of we can hear all kinds of terrible predictions about what might happen. We can worry about what we're going to do if something does happen. But I can guarantee that actually mindfulness is the best preparation. You know, if we're fully present when something difficult happens, there's a very good chance that we'll respond in the best possible way, that we'll know what to do or say. We don't have to plan it all out. Cultivating the habit of presence. This is the best preparation for the future, for whatever might happen. So it's a kind of insurance policy. The best insurance policy is cultivating our meditation practice, learning how to be present with the mind and the body just as they are. Not sitting down to meditate with a view to get something in the future, you know, to get the jhanas, to get enlightened, practicing meditation to cultivate presence, to keep coming back. Here, now, this breath, this body, this mind, just as it is, right here, right now. Learning about our strengths, bringing those forth, learning about our difficulties, the things that we don't do so well, and devising strategies, figuring out ways of working with the mind as it is, learning how to work with the conditioning that each one of us has. And one of the things I find helpful is just making up mantras, little ways of encouraging myself. Yeah, so I have all kinds of mantras, sort of things like, you're doing the best you can, or never mind, or it's all right. And for each person, it'll be something different. For each person, for each situation, each circumstance, something sort of hold steady. But we can only actually figure these out when we've actually established presence with ourselves, when we've only actually got to know ourselves a little bit better. Just using the spare moments in the day to just sit quietly, not meditating necessarily, but just sit quietly, noticing how it is. All of us have moments when there's nothing in particular going on, and we can just sit quietly. It's been very nice, it's been lovely being here in the monastery. And, being here as a visitor, I've not had very much to do. And there have been big chunks of time when I can just sort of sit on a bench and look. I was thinking today, oh, I'm really turning into an old lady, one of those old ladies that just kind of sits and looks and watches the birds and watches the deer and the hares and the people walking past, and just sitting and watching and watching the changing scenarios in my own mind, and watching what's going on in there, getting to know ourselves, making friends with ourselves. Really important. It can sound a bit indulgent, making friends with yourself, but it's really important that we learn how to relate to ourselves as we would relate to our dearest friend. With a heart of generosity, with a heart of kindness, with a heart of compassion, a heart of forgiveness. Setting aside that tendency to judge, to blame, to criticize. So it's useful for us to remember that the Buddha presented these teachings out of compassion. He didn't have to. He could have just stayed in a state of bliss and never taught anybody. In fact, he was a wee bit inclined to do that because he really didn't think people would understand. He could see that most people were totally addicted to being, to becoming, to sense pleasure, sense delight. And it was only because of the Brahma god Sahampati who came and pleaded with him and said, look, please, Lord, there are beings with just a little dust in their eyes who could understand, who would be willing to practice, if you would just, share what you're understanding. Please, out of compassion for them, share what you've understood. And so he did, out of compassion, because he wanted the very, very best for us. So he wasn't going to beat us up if we didn't get it quite right. He wasn't going to beat us up if our mind wandered a little bit or if we nodded off in our meditation. And he wanted the best for us. So maybe we should be a little bit more generous with ourselves. Maybe we should cultivate this heart of wanting the best for ourselves, wanting the best for each other, and creating the conditions that are going to support us in living more happily, more skillfully, or more wisely within this human realm for our own welfare and as an offering for the whole of humanity. This is something that human beings really, really need now, including all of the people who seem to be intent on creating havoc and confusion and following all kinds of less skillful impulses. And can we cultivate a heart of generosity, a heart of wishing the very, very best for them also? Sharing the blessings of our practice with the highest gods and all of those evil forces as well as the forces of goodness and generosity and virtue. So I think that's probably enough for now, and I really do wish the very, very best for each one of you. May everybody be enlightened in this very lifetime.
Sadhu, sadhu.